Americans are spending more and saving less. From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from our website, marketplace.org. Happy Friday. It is October 28th.
Coming up, Europe is on the mend. The U.S. economy is looking up. Is it for real this time?
Clocks in Europe will fall back this weekend, but not in Russia. And there are concerns that sticking to daylight saving time will have economic consequences.
And sometimes the number zero can make all the difference.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
Word today from the Commerce Department that consumer spending was up in September by more than 0.5%. And at the same time, Americans are saving less. They're not seeing as much growth in their income either. Jill Schlesinger is editor-at-large at CBS Money Watch, and she's with us from New York, as she is every Friday morning. Hey, Jill.
Good morning.
So it seems like people are spending a little money now, but at the expense of savings. What's going on?
Well, that's actually problematic. You know, the personal savings rate dropped to 3.6%. It's the lowest since December of 2007. In yesterday's GDP report, same trend that we saw. Here's the problem. When households increase their spending at the expense of savings, it's just not sustainable, and that makes these results somewhat suspect.
I know you just mentioned GDP numbers. The third quarter growth in the economy was about right on target, 2.5%. Is that enough growth, Jill, to really create jobs and get the economy going?
You know, that rate is just about the long-term average, but it's really low for a recovery to start to see real improvement in the jobs crisis. Growth needs to be above 3% for a few quarters in a row, you know, versus the herky-jerky results we've seen over the past few quarters.
Which was, what, 1.3% the quarter before?
And 0.4% the quarter before that.
Right. Jill Schlesinger from CBS Money Watch. Jill, thanks.
Great to be with you.
Well, that consumer spending news you guys were talking about is just another piece of data that we can add to yesterday's news that the U.S. economy grew at a rate of 2.5% over the summer. And, of course, there was the big news out of Brussels that there is a plan to deal with the debt crisis in Europe. For more on what all this means to the economy, let's bring in Mike Holland, CEO of Holland & Company. He's filling in for Chris Lowe this morning, and he joins us now from New Canaan, Connecticut. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So, Mike, some relief in Europe, some good news domestically. Have we turned a corner?
Quick answer is yes, with respect to Europe, because people had pretty much written off the possibility of anything constructive. This phrase, kicking the can down the road, had become a cliche about both Europe and the U.S. with respect to the politicians. And Angela Merkel, 24 hours ago, 48 hours ago, actually started something that surprised to the upside, a very positive development that she was able to craft. Even the naysayers are already out there, Jeremy, saying, well, this is one step in the right direction, but you know the hard work is yet to come. This is a major positive surprise, and the markets reflected that yesterday. Now the U.S. politicians have to go to work in November.
Well, that's the next question. I mean, we've got this super committee. Could that, these negotiations, which appear to be kind of deadlocked right now, could that end up like the debt ceiling debate and really put the economy in trouble again?
Yes, it could. Your question is perfectly phrased, and that's where we were a few days ago with respect to Europe. And Angela Merkel was able to surprise people. She did show leadership. She was able to bring together 17 disparate entities. As one WAG reported on it several days ago, it was like having 17 Nancy Pelosi's at the table and trying to get them to come together with something. And she did it. The U.S. politicians on both sides of the aisle have to come up with something. There's already been a salvo from each side, from the Republicans and from the Democrats, that this is a non-starter
right.
with respect to where we are. But that's where we were with the Europeans. Let's see if some of our people in Washington act like adults the way they did in Europe just a couple of days ago.
Mike Holland, CEO of Holland & Company, thanks very much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, Jeremy and Mike, Hewlett-Packard is keeping its $40 billion personal computer business. That's just a couple of months after proposing a separation of the PC division from the rest of the company. Now, the 180 came yesterday from HP's new leader, Meg Whitman, who used to run eBay and made an unsuccessful run last year at the governorship of California.
For more on what this move means for HP and for PCs in general, let's bring in Marketplace Tech Report host John Moe, who joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, John, I feel like every time we talk, we're talking about a company that has decided to do just the opposite of what they just said they were going to do. Why this reversal for HP?
Money. It was going to cost a lot of money to spin off the PC unit. You got to have real estate. You got to have operations. You're starting a whole new company that is already very, very active. And because it is active in the PC market, HP buys a lot of components like semiconductors. And right now it can get a good price on those because it buys so many for PCs, and that helps on all the things HP really wants to build, like servers and things that businesses have. It's a more predictable business, that kind of stuff, and it's not so fashion-oriented, but the PC still needs to be a pawn in that game.
But does the PC really have a future? It seems like all the movement these days is toward tablets and mobile devices.
Well, there's a future for personal computers. Whether that means an HP PC remains to be seen. But HP has also moved a lot towards cloud computing, and that's where a lot of consumers are moving to, using your computer as a portal while everything else is processed somewhere else. So HP has built up a lot of muscle in the cloud. If it can come up with a new kind of PC that connects well and works well, that might be a real opportunity for them.
Marketplace Tech Report host John Moe. John, thanks.
Thanks, Jeremy.
JP Morgan Chase has decided not to charge a monthly fee for using debit cards. Bank analysts say other banks will likely follow after watching Bank of America get pummeled with consumer complaints for its $5 a month fee. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
JP Morgan started experimenting with a $3 a month fee last February. The fee was only charged in Wisconsin and Georgia. It'll be dropped next month. So is the debit card fee idea dead? Bert Ely is a banking consultant in Virginia.
I don't think it's totally dead, but it has suffered a fatal wound. And that's why I believe Bank of America will either abandon their $5 a month fee altogether or at least substantially modify it.
That could mean B of A customers with high balances wouldn't have to pay the fee, or Ely says you could get around it by applying for one of the bank's credit cards. But he says all the major banks will continue experimenting with other types of fees. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective. Just a day after a big announcement to help the European debt crisis, the head of the Eurozone bailout fund is in Beijing today, asking for money to help raise the capacity of the fund by tens of billions of dollars. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us now from London with the latest on that story. Hey, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
The bailout deal, of course, has been approved. How much of this deal depends on the Chinese?
Well, a key part of that rescue package, as you say, is to more than double the firepower of the bailout fund to $1.4 trillion. The Financial Times says the Chinese might invest more than $100 billion, though I should stress the head of the bailout fund says he's not talking hard numbers in Beijing at the moment.
Why do they need money from China?
Because that's where the money is, to adapt that Willie Sutton quote. The Chinese are believed to be sitting on more than $3 trillion worth of reserves, while the Europeans either cannot or will not put up more cash themselves. The Chinese, in fact, have already put some money into the bailout fund. However, China expert Kerry Brown of the Chatham House think tank says a request for a very much bigger sum might raise a few eyebrows in China.
You've got a kind of Eurozone where the per capita GDP is at least seven times what it is in China. And yet they're being asked to come and bail out, you know, Europe. And it's a perception issue. You know, it's the sort of idea that they are having to help out rich countries remain rich.
However, he thinks the Chinese will be willing to invest. Europe's their biggest export market. They don't want to see it implode. And they do want to diversify away from their very big holdings of US dollar assets.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thank you.
Okay, Steve.
All this week, of course, we're helping you understand why Greece is such a threat to the global economy and why you should care about it. John Spotto heads up the Century Financial Planning Firm in Massachusetts, and he's with us now to talk about personal finance as it pertains to Greece and the Greek debt. He's with us now. Hey, John.
Hi, Steve.
What kinds of questions are your clients asking you about what's going on in Greece?
Right now, their biggest concern, as you might expect, is the effect that all of this is having on their investment portfolio, which, you know, includes obviously their retirement plans. And the big concern is, am I going to be okay? Will I be able to retire as planned? Will I be able to count on the money being there to help my child pay for college?
And what are you telling them, John?
These kinds of financial crises have occurred in the past. We've gotten through them. They will occur again in the future. And it is simply the price that we pay for investing and trying to earn better returns from the financial market, specifically the stock market.
But no doubt this stuff can be really scary, right, for people who have so much invested in their retirement or education savings plans?
Exactly. Understandably, it is. But the alternative of making short-term, rash, and let's say emotional decisions has just not proven to be an effective or profitable strategy.
How does a financial planner such as yourself, John, assess risks? Risks such as Greece in advance and shield your clients from it?
The only sensible way is explaining in advance, while we're helping them construct their portfolios, just how bad things can really get, to brace them for it, and then determine whether they've got the emotional ability and the financial capacity to be able to weather these downturns. If they're investing in stocks and they're doing so expecting a smooth ride, then they've really gotten into the market under false pretenses.
John Spotto, founder of Century Financial Planning. John, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Steve.
Well, this weekend, Steve, clocks will be falling back in Europe. We have to wait another week here in the United States that to happen. But in Europe, they're going to do it. However, in Russia, there will be no time change this year.
Really?
Yes, that's right. The country moved to summertime, as they call it there, or daylight saving time, as we would call it here, last March, as it has for the past 30 years. But it is not going back. That's it. It's going to stay an hour ahead all the time.
Wow.
Here's Peter Van Dyke from Moscow.
Moscow's long winter is only just starting, but the sun has been up less than 4 hours as the Kremlin clock strikes midday. By the end of the year, it will be 10 o'clock before Muscovites see the sun. That's because this year, Russia will not fall back to wintertime. The final part of President Dmitry Medvedev's time reforms puts Russia forever on summertime. The stress of changing the clocks forward and back is bad for our bodies, Medvedev says. And that's not to mention the poor cows, he jokes, who don't know when they are going to get milked. If the cows are confused, they can blame the farmers. Andrei Panin is a geography professor at Moscow State University. He says when the world's time zones were agreed on in 1884, they were designed for life on the farm. He says that these days, permanent summertime matches most Russians' daily schedule.
About half of territory of Russia and about two-thirds or three-quarters of population will live now through the whole year between 1 to 2 hours ahead of solar time, which fits well, from my point, to the lifestyle of an industrial society.
But being an hour further ahead of the US and Europe might not be so good for business. Kirill Yankovsky is an equities trader at UniCredit Bank in London. He says it creates problems for Russia's stock market.
I think it's not only separate, but it just gives an extra reason for people to focus on London.
Worse, Yankovsky says, Russian trading will be even further out of step with New York. Right now, there's a 1.5 hour overlap, but an hour of that will be lost when New York switches to wintertime. There's a danger that Medvedev moving Russia out of sync with the West could leave Russian traders and markets in the dark. In Moscow, I'm Peter Van Dyke for Marketplace.
So, Jeremy, have you heard about the latest trend in higher education?
What's that, Steve?
So you've heard of early morning classes, right?
Sure.
The kind that no one wants to sign up for. These days, some colleges are giving new meaning to the phrase burning the midnight oil.
Uh-huh.
They're actually holding class after midnight in the late,
wow.
late night hours. Yeah. USA Today reports some community colleges are having a tough time with space and faculty, and a lot of students are signing up for these classes. And in today's Midday Extra, we're going to look at the benefits and the possible harms. I'm sure there are plenty of both, of going to school in the middle of the night, kind of like what we do in the middle of the night, which is go to work.
Yeah, really. We know the dangers of that.
Yeah. There are many, as a matter of fact. Here to explain to us the benefits and the harms, too, of those classes in the middle of the night is Norma Kent of the American Association of Community Colleges. Hi, Norma.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. So thanks for being with us. Why would a college decide to hold a class in the middle of the night?
Well, it's all about serving students. You know, community colleges are known for access, and over the last few years, our enrollments have really got skyrocketed. So if you have a choice of not having a student get a class and having them have it at an unconventional hour, the choice is pretty clear for us.
Well, can you learn in the middle of the night? I mean, it's hard enough to think straight at that time of the day or night.
Well, clearly the students are learning. But, you know, we've had reports back from those brave faculty who have been willing to offer these kinds of classes, and they are indeed learning.
Yeah, we think about the students having to go to school. It's the teachers who have to teach it in the middle of the night,
right? That's exactly right.
So let's talk about some of the harms then. You know, Jeremy mentioned it's hard to even think in the middle of the night. What are some other things that they have to worry about?
Well, of course, it's a challenge for some people to be as sharp as they might be at, say, 10 a.m. in the morning. But, you know, a lot of people have a different time clock. So if it works for you, then, again, it's a choice of whether you get a class or don't get a class. And that class may be the difference for some students between getting a better job or getting a degree.
Is this at all related to the fact that so many people are having to work so many hours, especially to afford a college education these days? I mean, these people probably have jobs all day, maybe even into the evening, and they have to take the class in the middle of the night.
Well, community colleges are the most affordable option in higher education. But yes, many of these students do. In fact, about two-thirds of our students work either full or part-time while they go to college. So, you know, you have someone who may have a graveyard shift, and then they'll slide right into a diesel technology course.
You think, Norma, we're going to start seeing this kind of trend in other colleges as well besides community colleges, maybe one day Harvard or Stanford or one of the Ivy Leagues?
I can't speak for Harvard, but community colleges are pretty nimble, and if there's a need out there, they're going to find a way to serve.
I had a professor in college who told me that when I dropped his class about, I think, Latin American history, because it was at like 9 o'clock in the morning, he said, you know, I had a student once that said, I don't take any classes before 2 o'clock in the afternoon or above the second floor.
Oh, wow. That's pretty picky right there.
Well, anyway, but, you know, these days I would do the middle of the night. All right. Norma Kent of the American Association of Community Colleges, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you both.
This morning, NASA launched a new $1.5 billion weather satellite into space. It is designed to help predict and even mitigate the cost of extreme weather events. Well, as Marketplace's Eve Trow reports, knowing more farther ahead of time could bring the eventual costs of natural disasters down.
Compared to a huge space shuttle launch, a weather satellite doesn't look so impressive, says Andrew Carson at NASA.
It's about 14.5 feet long. So it's equivalent to a medium-sized SUV.
But the data that humble satellite transmits is invaluable, says scientist Mitch Goldberg at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. His lab calculated weather forecasts without satellites. Remember when Snowmageddon dumped more than 2 feet of snow on the East Coast? Without satellite data,
the forecast was only 7 to 10 inches of snow. So you can imagine what the big economic impact of that would be. I mean, you wouldn't be able to plan days in advance on how to mitigate severe snow events.
In addition to weather patterns, the satellite also carries new technology to measure land and sea temperature, ozone levels, crop productivity, and more. All that data is offered free to the public, and it's used to do everything from predicting droughts and disease to coming up with insurance rates. I'm Eve Trow for Marketplace.
Now to New York City, a little sliver of it right in the middle of the East River called Roosevelt Island. Steve, the city wants to turn part of the island into a high-tech hub.
Hmm.
And today is the deadline to submit proposals for a new School of Applied Sciences. Sally Herships has more.
Build it and they will come. Engineers, entrepreneurs, and jobs, that is. At least that's what New York City is counting on. The city is offering free land in return for building a school of applied sciences. Think tech and engineering. Colleges like Stanford, Cornell, and the University of Chicago are applying. Here's Kellogg professor Shane Greenstein.
I don't think it's an accident. We're not observing broke state schools, you know, with funding problems in on these biddings.
Building an entire school for a university is pricey. Stanford estimates the cost at $2.5 billion. But a New York City campus focused on high tech could mean more research dollars. Doug Lynch is vice dean of the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate School of Education.
Having a foothold in New York City for any institution, particularly given the incentives that the administration is providing, is quite attractive.
No matter who wins, Lynch says trading away New York City's valuable real estate is risky. Don't forget, universities are tax-free. In New York, I'm Sally Hershovs for Marketplace.
And finally, to Sicily, and a story that actually seems just a little too weird to be true. I don't really know if I believe this one, but you decide, Steve,
okay,
all right? Police issued a $44,000 ticket for a car that had been parked illegally for a long time.
Not true.
That seems a little bit odd. $44,000. The problem, according to reports, was that the police officer who issued the ticket accidentally dated the violation to the year 208 AD as opposed to 2008, which
so
also seems
so
a little not believable.
Hundreds of years.
Yeah,
of
I'm
interest,
sure that never.
Yeah.
It's weird that the computers were able to calculate back to 208.
Well,
AD.
At least it wasn't BC. I mean, that would have been the
that
big
would have
problem,
been a
right?
Problem,
yeah, it would have gone way far back.
So the ticket included 1,800 years of interest, and this story, I think, will have interest in it for another 1,800 years. So there you go, double it. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. Have yourselves a great weekend. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.